Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Sasha Adi, host of the PCOS Challenge radio show, designed to help women overcome polycystic ovarian syndrome, a hormonal and reproductive disorder that affects 1 in 10 women of childbearing age. We'll be bringing you the best information on fertility, hirsutism, weight loss, nutrition, mental health, and other conditions surrounding PCOS. The goal of the PCOS Challenge is to inspire and motivate you to make positive changes in your life. So tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. This is Sasha Adi. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge. Hello, everyone. This is Sasha Adi, host of the PCOS Challenge radio show and also the PCOSChallenge.com support site. And today our show is Ask the Endocrinologist About PCOS with our special guest, Dr. Walter Futterwhite. And Dr. Futterwhite is a clinical professor of medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, a clinical and research endocrinologist, and has devoted over 30 years to the study of polycystic ovary syndrome and its pathophysiology, treatment, and manifestations. He's also president of the Androgen Excess and PCOS Society, author of A Patient's Guide to PCOS, and is a member of a number of organizations, including the Endocrine Society, American Diabetes Association, and the American College of Physicians. He has a very, very impressive resume and continues to see patients at his practice in New York. Dr. Futterwhite, we are very, very honored and thrilled to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Adi, and I indeed am pleased to be here, and I want to congratulate you for the work you have been doing, and am delighted to be part of your communication to patients on a syndrome that 30 years ago was considered actually rare by the National Institute of Health. So it is.
And look how much has changed since then.
Things do change, and much research has really been focused on it recently. And the early 80s was really the time when a major breakthrough came. It was a time when insulin was noted to be an important factor in the development of the syndrome. So I want to say hello to everyone, and I hope that you will be able to hear me properly. And
I'm hearing you loud and clear.
Okay. I wanted to be sure the communication was all right. And I'm delighted you're all on. Thank you.
You're welcome. So there's going to be a lot of information offered today, and I don't want to get on a roll and forget to ask you, you're currently seeing patients, right? You're still accepting patients in your practice?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so please give us your contact information to begin with.
It's the New York City office at 1172 Park Avenue, and it is New York City, New York, 10128. Telephone number is 212-876-6400.
Okay, because I know we can get on a roll and forget to mention that, but so I wanted to get that out the way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so in your professional opinion, what is PCOS? Is it a reproductive disorder, an endocrine disorder, a metabolic disorder, a combination? What is it?
Probably all. PCOS is not a disease. It is a syndrome. Syndrome is different. If you have a patient who has an underactive thyroid, you have certain signs and symptoms, and confirmatory laboratory evidence which point to the diagnosis, and many show the same features. In polycystic ovary syndrome, there are numerous factors, but the important factors in terms of its definition by a number of groups, and the recent two major definitions have been by a group in Rotterdam in 2004 and the Androgen Excess PCOS Society. The basic problem and diagnostic tool has to be recognized, because lack of recognition of this important syndrome can lead to diabetes, insulin resistance, which means basically, as I will mention the term perhaps a number of times, the absence of an adequate response to taking in sugar in a meal or in a snack. These are the two major factors, and the fact that there may be skin manifestations, the most important in the sense of diagnosis being the development of abnormal hair growth where hair growth should not occur.
So what specifically does a doctor look for when a patient presents? What's the actual diagnostic criteria?
The diagnostic criteria are basically the patient can be overweight, the patient can be lean, and in the United States, 50% are overweight, and about 50% are lean or just slightly overweight. The diagnostic symptoms are those of inability to ovulate normally. That means that there is chronic anovulation, and the term, as you stated correctly, is that it affects anywhere from 6 to 10% of women of childbearing age. And PCOS is the most common cause of female infertility due to anovulation, and probably is just about as common as thyroid disease in young women. So, as I said, the major definition, and the one I stand by, is the definition of hair growth in abnormal places and or the finding of elevated testosterone, male hormone, in the blood. Now, some people and some ethnic groups may not show hirsutism because of their ethnicity or genetic predisposition not to respond to male hormones. So you may have...
What ethnic groups would you be referring to?
Asian women in Scandinavia, they really are unlikely to have any significant amount of abnormal hair growth. And the finding would be that if a woman has erratic periods and she may have major changes, classic changes on an ultrasound, the finding of an abnormal testosterone, or what we call a free testosterone, namely the abnormality of having a free-flowing male hormone in the blood, which can go to a section of the skin which normally does not have hair, and produce hair. So that basically is the definition.
Right, so that's
and
why we do get hirsutism and acne, probably other skin abnormalities.
Yes, hirsutism, however, is more important. Acne is common in many young women, but if there is severe acne, and this is very important, if the acne, let's say, persists until the mid-20s, which is not a normal thing, and some may persist until their 30s, you know, there has to be a reason for this. And it is up to the endocrinologist to find out why. There are a number of other type of diseases. These are diseases of the adrenal gland, of the pituitary gland, and certain other types of disorders where it may mimic those that I defined previously. These have to be excluded by testing. And insofar as the ultrasound goes, remember, one out of four women have some features of polycystic ovaries on the ultrasound if done carefully and by a well-trained technician or physician. So
one out of four women in general, or one of four
in general, in general. And that has been written a long time ago. So the finding of polycystic ovaries is not necessarily a diagnosis. That doesn't mean anything, but it is, although it can happen rarely, it can be useful in women with erratic periods who may not have hair growth, abnormal hair growth, and who have polycystic ovaries according to the Rotterdam criteria. Ours at the Androgen Access Society differs.
Okay, so a woman goes to her doctor, her physician. What tests should a doctor actually, what blood tests should a doctor do to rule out PCOS?
The major test is the testosterone. It is also the finding, and I consider it second of importance, of insulin levels in the blood. And we're talking about fasting levels, 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And when the hormone levels are at their baseline. In other words, the cortisone levels are at their appropriate levels, which are a little elevated in the morning, and so forth. The next of important hormone to be analyzed are the adrenal hormones. And that goes for something called 17-hydroxyprogesterone. I know these are tough terms. To many of you,
it's okay. I'm sure there are people writing these down.
And the important thing is, it has to be done, but it should be done if the periods are fairly regular at the time, basically, of day 5 to day 9 of the cycle. So if a period starts, let's say, at day 1. So if the periods come on regularly, and a woman is still infertile or whatever, the day 5 to 9, 17-hydroxyprogesterone is important because it excludes the possibility of a significant hormone disorder called non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which comes from a genetic defect of chromosome 21 and which are present in, again, in more commonly in a number of ethnic groups, including certain Eastern European, what we call Ashkenazi women, Alaskan women, Indian women. As a matter of fact, in India, one out of five women, according to the Indian physicians who have written on this, have polycystic ovary syndrome. So it is indeed also a genetic syndrome for many reasons, which I'm sure from the questions we'll be able to get into. So other than the finding of adrenal abnormalities, we do something called, if you can write down the term, DHEAS. I don't want to give you the long-term dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate. That's a little tough. So DHEAS, I would get a prolactin. This is a pituitary hormone, which is present in about 10 to 15% of women with the polycystic ovary syndrome, or in women who just happen to have a tiny little growth that may hinder ovulation and can cause some hair growth and even some hair loss. Prolactin should be done. Thyroid function should always be done, but which endocrinologist doesn't do it? T4 and TSH. The other hormone of importance is something made by the liver called a sex hormone binding globulin, SHBG. Now, insulin causes the suppression of the sex hormone binding globulin. Now, so what, you may say? So it causes suppression. Well, the sex hormone binding globulin is the protein which actually binds to the free testosterone molecules that float in the blood and attack the hair follicles or cause further lack of ovulation. So it is very important because there is medication that can alter and change the insulin and make it easier for the patient to conceive. So, of course, you want to also get the other routine chemistries, liver tests. You want to get an ultrasound regardless. And if one really suspects PCO on a patient, after you do all this, you should see and check, particularly if there is a family history of diabetes mellitus, type 2 diabetes. You should get a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, not just for the glucose at 0 and 2 hours, but I've made it a practice, as many do, and it is really mandatory to get a glucose tolerance test, because I have seen overweight and obese teenagers with diabetes already in their late teens. So it is important to know already what you're dealing with. Are you dealing with pre-diabetes, where the 2-hour sugar may be 140 or up to 200? Or is it normal? So this is really quite important. Basically, those are the major types of workups you should do in the beginning. And, of course, get a careful family history. And on that score, let me just say, let's say you have two sisters. The chances are pretty good that at least one out of two of the siblings of a confirmed patient with polycystic ovary syndrome has the syndrome herself. So
let me ask you something about that. And, you know, you've answered probably most of the questions on my list of questions to ask you, and then we're going to go into listener questions. But you just mentioned the genetic link. My sister, she's always been underweight. I've always been overweight. And she's been pretty much overlooked. One of her doctors said there's no way she has PCOS. She doesn't look like she has PCOS. And so many lean women with PCOS get overlooked. So what should they tell these doctors, or how should they approach a doctor when trying to figure out if they have PCOS or not?
This is a difficult patient of who is not really happy with being told there's no way you have PCOS because you're thin, because most patients do a lot of reading on PCOS now, and there are some books on it now, for the layperson, that is.
Right.
It is well known throughout the world. It's in China, it's in Siberia, it's all over. And the fact is that the physician has to get the history, of course. There can be testosterone that are quite high. There are patients who are also really high in testosterone who may have virilizing tumors, that is, some growths of the adrenal gland or ovaries that can cause very high testosterone levels. And, of course, these things would be demonstrable by the type and degree of hair or growth that even a skinny, lean young lady may have. And I want to go later into, and I hope I'm asked about this, the severe emotional trauma of having this syndrome, I mean, having this. And so much literature is now coming out on the impact of the polycystic ovary syndrome on self-image and on social contacts and so many other factors.
Oh, yes, we're definitely going to get into that. Many, many people have asked questions about that. Okay, so let me actually get into some of the listener questions, and I think we also have some callers.
Sure.
So first is Isabel from Sweden. She has a problem with getting the doctors to understand what PCOS means, and she's been seeing a PCOS specialist who's a gynecologist for 10 years, and she asked him to refer her to an endocrinologist, and his latest reply was, what can an endocrinologist do? And so her question is, what can an endocrinologist do for women with PCOS?
Well, it depends on what their complaints are, and there are so many complaints. We know that insulin resistance is a serious thing, potentially serious. Because later on in life, the incidence of diabetes is rather significant. So anyone who's obese, by the way, with polycystic ovary syndrome, by the age of 30 will have diabetes, or at least have the tendency to have it, in other words, pre-diabetes. The IGT is the term, impaired glucose tolerance. There you go again with the glucose tolerance test, and I'm saying it again, it is a very important thing. What can an endocrinologist do? Well, we can see if there's insulin resistance. We can't do the fancy clamp studies, but there are ways by measuring insulin and glucose we can calculate to some extent the degree and presence of insulin resistance. And I assume she's Scandinavian, she probably is thin. So she belongs to that group of patients that are overlooked the most and have been overlooked. And unfortunately, I still see some that are told the same thing. And it is, frankly, something that is not a good thing. And I can tell you quite frankly, at this point, most physicians really know polycystic ovary syndrome rather well. The internists and gynecologists, of course, and the dermatologists, they play a very important role. So the only question a dermatologist should ask, really, other than looking for hair growth, abnormalities, and so forth, is how are your periods? One simple question. So that can be of great help. Now, the question that the young lady from Finland asked, there are many things we can do. We can reduce later risks, although in lean women, the the risks are less, particularly if the family history is more benign. We can reduce the male hormone level by affecting the sex hormone binding globulin by administration of, frankly, the birth control pill, and this together with metformin, which directly inhibits the insulin, is a major way that we can really improve the quality of life as well, because frankly, very often after 2 weeks, the patient feels more energetic. I'm not saying all patients, but many, and
what
emotionally they feel better. Yes.
Now, I was going to ask you, what about the women who are having trouble tolerating metformin? Because that's also a very, very common question.
Very common.
GI disturbances, yes.
This will be of interest to many of you. The patients that I see that have intolerance to metformin, very often they're on several major reasons. And you know the most common reason? The most common reason is they don't follow their directions properly. It has to be taken with food. It must be taken with food. The stomach has to be moderately full, because for metformin, not to give side effects, it has to be taken with food. If it's taken an hour after meals, and I see it, frankly, in half the patients that don't tolerate metformin, they don't take it right, and they don't take it at the right time. They get nauseous. If they take it, let's say, even a half an hour before they eat, there's nothing in the stomach. And they get ill, they get bloated, and they may get some loose bowel movements. But the fact also is there are some patients that just can't tolerate some of the effects of metformin, particularly the way it tastes. Sometimes there is a bad taste by some, occasionally, by some generic forms. In those instances, you change to the brand, or you may change to the extended-release metformin and take it at one time. So many of patients that have intolerance to metformin, as I said, in number one is because they don't take it correctly, and number two is the fact that they may be told to take it too quickly. My schedule is I give it one tablet a day with food for a week, every day. Second week, one in the morning, one in the evening. Third week, one in the morning, two in the evening. Fourth week, two and two. The patient is to call if there's any discomfort or loose bowel movements. Frankly, most of the side effects will generally go away by 6 weeks. And the one side effect that, however, can stay to some extent is the presence of loose bowel movements.
Yeah, that's the most common, complaint.
Yes.
Okay. And so in that instance,
yes. In that instance, you try to change, first of all, from taking metformin to extended release. You try to take all the metformin in one shot, and it's usually taken before bedtime with some food in the stomach, and that may do it. Reducing the dosage of metformin instead of taking four, which is the actually 2,000 milligrams, 4 times 500 milligrams, is the appropriate dose for a woman with polycystic ovary syndrome, lean or obese.
Oh, well, I've heard numbers much higher than that. People are being prescribed very, very high dosage. Actually, one of the questions was about that. Someone is taking really high doses of metformin. I think 5,000.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard really, really high numbers.
May I say something?
Yes.
There are three articles I know of that that describe the benefits in obese women of using 2,500 milligrams. And frankly, it does have a beneficial effect in helping them get some more menses and perhaps cut down the craving and serious craving, which the obesity in and of itself, because of its insulin resistance and the presence of PCOS, has for carbohydrates. It's almost like an addiction, and it really isn't their fault. It's the insulin resistance which causes most of the problems which these women have later on, which include, of course, the presence of diabetes and the potential, unfortunately, for early cardiovascular disease. So this is important to, if necessary, to use 5, but it's not something I like to do. Although, if a patient usually, my dictum has been, if the patient usually takes 4 without any side effects, he tolerates 5 without any either. So I think I've been lucky.
You have been. Okay, well, I'm going to actually take a caller.
Yes.
We have a lot of questions to get through. Okay, caller from 443, do you have a question for Dr. Sutter-White?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Can
okay.
I help you?
Next. Caller from 301, do you have a question for Dr. Sutter-White?
Well, hi. I have a question. It's a two-part question. You're mentioning metformin, because I can't take metformin. I had the whole GI issue. So my doctor put me on Actos. Does Actos work the same way metformin does for women with PCOS? And my second question, have you heard anything on the effects of Enapal on women with PCOS?
The effects in Enapal?
Inositol.
Oh, inositol. That's been worked. I'll tend to that question first, the last one. Yes, my colleague and outstanding authority on metformin, Dr. John Nessler, has done some research on this, as he did on diazoxide earlier, to show the effect of anti-insulin. It was done in a research lab. It has not been in any way, and I've been in touch with him. When is it going to come out? Well, it's not. There's just no demand for it. People seem to be very satisfied with metformin, which, by the way, is the number one drug for type 2 diabetes. So many, many people take it. And the use of the metformin in polycystic ovary syndrome is an off-label use. That means it's not in the physician's desk reference to use for polycystic ovary syndrome, but physicians use it for that. The first part, Actos, works through a totally different mechanism. It also has beneficial effects, but unfortunately, if you're trying to become pregnant, you can't use it because there are no data, and it is potentially a category where it may be dangerous to the fetus. So if you wish to become pregnant, there is no way you should be taking Actos. I hope that answers it.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Okay, caller from 973, do you have a question for Dr. Sutter-White?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on to the chat room questions. Someone, Jessie, she says she doesn't ovulate and has recently tried Clomid. I know you're not a fertility specialist.
But this is important. Go ahead.
Yeah, she said several months after not working, she started having adrenal and pituitary issues along with severe panic attacks, and they started her on prednisone. Any suggestions for the anxiety? I know this is a passion of yours, depression and anxiety. And
yes. Well, I've been interested in that, and I tend to feel that there is so much of a depression, and what really contributes to a worsening of the syndrome is not just the fact that they have psychological factors, namely also allied disorders like anxiety, personality changes, hostility, isolation, and chronic and poor relationships and so forth. But stress, unfortunately, worsens many of the potential serious side effects of the syndrome. And I hope we get questions about the facts of what the polycystic ovary syndrome can do. Because this is at the core. It has to be treated. And the main, if I may just say, the main reason for treatment is avoidance of later complications, which include diabetes and hypertension as well, and the fact that they have to be treated for the probability that they have hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis.
Wow. Okay. So, next question. We're going to move through some of these a little quickly so we can get to more people.
Yes.
Nikki said she has other types of issues, including hand swelling, gallbladder disease. And actually, there was somebody else who asked about gallbladder disease and if there's a relationship to PCOS.
No.
I'm sorry. I'm experiencing some really heavy weather over here. I hope that doesn't disturb.
No, I hear you well. The gallbladder disease is often noted because very often some physicians do an abdominal ultrasound, too, to look at the adrenal glands and to look at the liver. The liver is affected, interestingly, in about 70% of overweight women. They develop a fatty liver, and this is also present in thin women, but in much lesser amounts, about 40%. So the fact is that the anxiety that she may have and so forth is probably due to the fact that she is just having the worries and complications, problems which she is trying to solve, and she may not be able to solve it on her own, and she needs an experienced endocrinologist.
Okay. And someone is having problems absorbing vitamin D, and she's very underweight and cannot gain weight. Is that common?
You mean is there a relationship between vitamin D and inability
and
to gain weight?
And yes.
There are, by the way, I can start by telling you right out when the reviews of depression are read, and much is really present in the literature. Eating disorders occur in 1 out of 3 women with PCOS, period. So the fact that she wants to lose weight, she's already thin, she wants to lose weight, that's not...
she wants to gain weight. Are you speaking about in general?
Well, I mean, she wants to gain weight? Well,
she's
underweight. She thin or what?
Yeah, she's underweight.
Oh, okay. She may be binging, or she's having an problem in terms of what she is trying to do, and obviously it's part of the emotional effects of polycystic ovary syndrome, and many young women in college do this, as many know.
Okay. Yeah, she said, no, she doesn't. She's in the chat room. She doesn't, and she's just underweight. She can't gain weight. And
this is unusual for PCOS because it's usually the other way around. You can't lose weight. Because that's probably the number one complaint. Doctor, I can't lose weight. Or I'm really depressed. And hirsutism is really down the list, about three or four, what they come into infertility.
Oh, yes. Infertility, weight gain, and are probably the top complaints that
Absolutely.
So for the lady who's having trouble gaining weight, what would you suggest to her?
Well,
she said
if
it
she has trouble gaining weight, it
her.
May have nothing to do with the polycystic ovary syndrome, because
okay.
You have to look at the profile, the examination. Does she have the features of polycystic ovary syndrome, or is it really polycystic ovary syndrome? You know that of patients coming in, I would say at least 10-15% don't have it. And they come in with an ultrasound.
Ones who have already been diagnosed with PCOS?
Yeah, they've been diagnosed, and they really don't have it. So you have to follow the definitions, and that goes for your physician. I mean, you can read about it and so forth, but I'm sure your physician reads about it.
Okay. Next question is a 26-year-old from India. She suffers from androgenic alopecia, and she's on metformin for a few months, but her hair loss problem got worse. She said she's becoming bald, and her endocrinologist has now given her finasteride and spironolactone. And she's tried to find out she's trying to find more information about it, and she's trying to figure out if this is a good
thing
can help her with her androgen.
Now, it is very important if she is married or seeing somebody.
She said she's unmarried and not trying to get pregnant right now.
Oh, okay. But regardless, in the treatment of alopecia, and frankly, you know, that was a major lecture at a recent meeting in Munich of the Androgenic Polycystic Ovary Association. The fact is that you need the pill in association with something that blocks the effect of male hormone or its conversion to a product called DHT from entering the hair follicle, dihydrotestosterone. Now, the question is a very good one, and it's very intelligently stated. How does it work? Well, it works very simply. It doesn't allow to any extent the production of finasteride we're talking about now.
Right.
It doesn't allow the production of DHT. It cuts it down by about 60 to 70%. And the dosage has to be more than men use in Proscar for improving their hair growth. It has to be 5 milligrams a day. I've used finasteride, not personally.
Not personally.
But I've used it quite a bit in my practice. I find it helpful in alopecia. But there, not to get complicated, there are different types of alopecia. And I would also make sure a dermatologist makes a diagnosis that it is male hormone related and that it is not due to medication, stress, or the possibility that she may not be eating adequate amounts of red meat, which can cause iron deficiency, zinc deficiency, and B12 deficiency. So the fact of the finasteride, and even though she doesn't need the birth control pill, it will be very helpful because it would suppress the further stimulation also of the male hormone. So a combination with the addition of the birth control pill, something like, well, I don't want to give brand names, but a good one and a well-known one. Frankly, orthotrichine.
So how close to when she's trying to conceive can she use this finasteride?
She has to be off for at least 3 to 6 months.
And does that pretty much go for all of the similar types of
anti-androgen?
Yeah.
Yes. And this is, I mean, trust me, they haven't done studies on this because who would study something like this? But to be sure, and from the knowledge obtained from spironolactone, which is Altactone, it's been around for 50 years. And fact is that already, you know, it has happened where women do take it, and it is always best to be sure. And the effect of having abnormalities actually is pretty rare. I have to say, you know, I myself...
It's rare, but we don't want to take that chance.
Exactly, it's rare because there are very few where this really happens to because they've been warned and they have to be on the pill.
Okay.
That was a good question.
Yeah. Okay. So next question is, I get this so much, and I know you get this all the time. This is Amy, and she's 39 years old, and she says she wants off the roller coaster rides of horrible periods that have caused emergency room visits, emergency D&Cs due to lack of periods for 6+ months at a time, and then hemorrhage for a month or more at a time. Is hysterectomy my only option? I got to tell you, I get a lot of questions about hysterectomy because so many women who bleed heavily and have these painful and huge clots, doctors have told them that hysterectomy is the only way to go. And this is what Amy's doctor is telling her now.
Well, I don't want to disagree or say anything about how gynecologists treat this. I would first find out from a very good ultrasonographer if there are any polyps. They have to do other studies to see if there are any other causes of bleeding. And in rare instances, it could be a systemic disorder where it could be a bleeding disorder. So you have to look in the family history of bleeding disorders. Is she on medication which potentially can cause a change in the clotting factors? And paradoxically, I have to say, you know, in the polycystic ovary syndrome, even though this can occur, erratic, heavy bleeding, and can occur in young patients, too, in their teens and 20s and 30s. It's called dysfunctional bleeding. There could be a reason for this, namely the erratic waves and stimulation of the uterus. And sometimes, not too often, happily, there can be a tumor of the uterus, which is not an unknown complication of polycystic ovary syndrome, and of interest, it can, in certain hands, experienced hands, be treated with progesterone and not hysterectomy.
Right. Okay. And so for a person who's experienced, you know, this a lot and have had multiple D&Cs, is endometrial ablation a possibility for treatment, or should she get a second opinion, you know, go seek out a certain type of doctor?
Well, again, we have here a gynecological type of situation, and I really don't have the full knowledge to give you an exact answer.
Right. Okay.
I have to be frank.
So,
I don't talk about something I'm not 100% sure.
Which is very smart, which I'm sure, Okay, so, so this is another huge question. It's in the chat room. Other people sent questions in. How does one get rid of excess hair?
Well, there are a number of types and the ones, you know, there are a number of patients who actually like electrolysis, and it seems to be a permanent, nice solution, and there's nothing wrong with it. It is painful for a while, although there can be local anesthetic supply. What is used now and has to be done is, for the most part, the type of individual. If they have light hair, they're not very good candidates, you know, for the abnormal hair removal, although it can be done to some extent. But laser is really, has taken a major role in the removal of hirsutism. And it has to be done frequently. And with anti-androgen therapy, it doesn't have to be done as often. So you have the benefit of therapy, namely the chemical therapy to suppress male hormone levels, and the use of laser by, again, an experienced university-based expert who has had experience with these patients who have been difficult for certain.
So find an experienced
yes, university
experience, medical person.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Next question: should one be routinely testing insulin levels if she's on metformin? If so, should a fasting insulin blood test be ordered, or is there a better test to see if your insulin levels are improving?
Well, the important follow-up on metformin, frankly, is that you want to see the effect on insulin, to see that it goes down to more normal level. If the levels of insulin do not decline significantly, maybe due to several reasons. It could be the fact that the metformin may not be given in adequate doses. It could be the fact that the patient may not be taking the metformin properly or with a full stomach, which has acid, which allows the metformin to be absorbed properly into the GI tract. So this is basically the situation. If the metformin works properly, the insulin level should really go down, and the ratio of that, the calculation of what we call the homeostatic insulin resistance model, HOMA-IR, is then calculated, and one can see the efficiency of having an effectiveness of having the metformin used. So in most instances, metformin is very helpful in reducing insulin levels and also in reducing some of the early complications of infertility, which we haven't spoken about.
Okay, well, we'll speak about infertility now. Before that, how does one get an appointment with you?
Well, I guess just look at my website and the phone number 212-876-6400. I think I'm embarrassed.
No, actually, someone was asking from the chat room.
Oh.
Okay, so here's another lean woman with PCOS. She's 5'5", 126 pounds. She's having fertility issues due to lack of ovulation.
Yeah.
However, she has a normal cycle that arrives every 28 to 30 days.
Sure.
And her doctor recommends trying Clomid, and she's been reading that many lean PCOS women are not having success with this method, and her doctor disagreed, but she says everything's geared towards heavier women, et cetera, and she doesn't quite know what direction to go in.
With all due respect to this nice patient, and she's been reading a lot of differences of opinion. There is a lot of literature, and John and I, actually, Dr. Messel and I, were part of this in Endocrine News from the Endocrine Society. The metformin actually works best in lean women, in thin women, believe it or not. And
okay.
The effectiveness of having good results improved dramatically. So I have to say, and this has been my experience too, I look forward to thin women getting metformin because I know already that they're going to respond significantly, most of them, in terms of having periods. Having a period does not mean having ovulation.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So
That's very important to get across.
This is an important fact to state. So he wants to use Clomid. That's fine. Actually, I have to say, in the recent meeting again in Munich, and trust me, all I'm not jet lagged. I feel fine. And I felt fine right away. But this came up, and the main people involved, Dr. LeGros, who I respect greatly, who wrote about it in the New England Journal of Medicine, and all people didn't have to argue much anymore. Clomiphene has some advantages over metformin. Metformin, however, has an advantage in not having multiple births, in not having some problems with the eyes, and also in improving the effectiveness early in pregnancy. So, there's great debate on this, but I think the debate is waning. And this is the beauty of having the people who really know about PCOS meet in groups of people who may have different views. And we think about it and so forth. So Clomid is a good drug. But it can be used together with the metformin, too, so you have the benefit of both.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Okay,
a very good question, by the way.
Okay. We have a few more questions. Somebody got a lap band for weight loss.
Yes.
She said it worked for her. She lost some weight. But she still has fertility issues. What's next?
Again, I don't know it's difficult to say because a lot of these things depend on prior history, how heavy she was, how rapidly she developed the weight loss. Did she lose weight too quickly? Were there problems relating to the important fact that having even lap band surgery can reduce certain important changes in mineral content, and the use and the importance of having these particularly early in the phase. So I, without having the data, there isn't much I can really say other than making sure that the bariatric surgeon gets her to an endocrinologist again to follow up.
This next question is also very common. Jen has been prescribed metformin. She doesn't know exactly why. Her blood sugars have always been normal. She doesn't have diabetes. Can you please explain what it does for people with PCOS who have normal levels?
That is an absolute question.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, you see, you have such differences of opinion. Metformin has about 30 positive effects, from reducing triglycerides to not only cutting down the insulin, but delaying possibly the presence of diabetes. And if the woman is thin, it will work better. But still, even in the obese patient, it has the benefit of improving the lipids to some extent, which is important. Triglycerides are very important. The effect on the liver is questionable. I'm not sure it really has a good effect on cutting down on the fatty liver. But the use of metformin is mainly now in getting her to help her with lifestyle modification. I'm going to repeat this. This is the number one treatment that hasn't even come up. Lifestyle modification. That means learning to eat the right portions, eating the right food, getting a good nutritionist who knows what they're doing. If you're overweight, there's no way you're going to lose weight if you don't eat less than 1,200 calories. It's tough, I know, but not every obese patient wants to be pre-diabetic or actually diabetic, and almost, more than half already are by the menopause. So remember, the fact is, if they had menopause changes, let's say, of diabetes, the probability is almost, well, I would say it varies in literature, but some say as high as 50%, that half of the women who have diabetes before or just at the time of the menopause have had right along polycystic ovary syndrome, and she's already, I don't want to say trouble, but she's going to have a tough time in reducing complications of high blood pressure, lipid disturbances, carotid artery changes, coronary artery changes. The fact is that a diagnosis, and I plead for this, and that's why you deserve so much credit yourself, really. You have had now a show which, with the PCOS challenge, tells a lot of women really what to do and how to do it and so forth. But it's only the beginning, and I hope I can do it again later.
Yes, absolutely. We'll get through a few more questions, and
sure,
then I will allow you to leave in a relatively time.
You're so
time.
Sweet. Yeah.
What's her name? Understated is her name, and her primary care doctor.
Oh, it's a nice name. I like it.
Yes. Yeah. Her primary care doctor told her to get labs for LH-FSH ratio, prolactin, progesterone, but she was told that those have to be done on certain cycle days. How
she's right.
Yes.
The understated lady is right.
Yes, she said, how can we get these done if we don't currently have a cycle?
Well, there's no point in the LH-FSH ratio, first of all, is going to be present whether she has a cycle or not. If there are no periods, particularly, doesn't make a difference. At other times, I like to keep the bloods, as I mentioned, between days 5 to 9, if the periods are there, even if they're there once every 2 months or so. I still like it at a certain time. You know why? Because you dilute out many of the additional factors and additional hormones that may be coming from the adrenal if you were to draw it in the second phase. If you're interested in the second phase and want to know if you ovulate, you do it with progesterone. But, this patient is correct. The LH-FSH ratio is not really, however, that useful. It is present in virtually all thin women with PCOS. But the heavier women and obese women, you don't see it often. So it is not a very important test. It's just a test that is useful and may be present in other conditions as well.
Okay. And we did go over the prolactin and progesterone earlier.
Yes.
So everyone can listen to the replay and, whatever you missed in the beginning, Dr. Butterwhite really did give some great advice on what to test and the markers for PCOS. And Jennifer E. wants to know what's going on in the body when you have a strong craving for sweets like Kool-Aid or candy, and I also have other questions from people along the same lines.
Okay. What is happening, obviously, is that there is hyperinsulinism. the term hyperinsulinism, too much insulin, meaning there are people, particularly if you have your doctor do the 2-hour glucose tolerance test, off the metformin, of course, where the insulin levels, although they may be in the normal or slightly elevated range, and my normal is 13 and over. 13 and over is abnormal. Less than 13, between 10 and 13 is borderline, below 10 is the best. But there are some patients who start with a 10 who go up to 300 at 2 hours. Now, that is a super booming response. And you can only tell it, and the glucose really would show minor changes, but the action is all in the insulin. So the insulin response is a very important one. So
okay.
that really is important. Yes.
The other patient who craves sweets,
yes.
She said she'll sometimes drink soda, eat a piece of candy. She said she's already on 2,000 milligrams of metformin. And she's not sure if it's working because she's still craving sugar.
I'm sure she must have had some reduction in sugar if she took it correctly. If she didn't take it correctly, again, the old business again of not being absorbed properly. That happens so often. So check always with yourself and remember this, if you remember one thing about metformin. Take it as directed. If you read the PDR, if you listen to your physician, take it with food, a moderately full stomach, and never, never take any food or any meal with carbohydrates alone. That is not a good thing to do. You need proteins with it. And if there are cravings of this sort, going to five,
makes a big difference, right?
It does. If
yeah.
If you take five, and if that is if you're obese and not responding, or if you have a body mass index, let's say, of being close to obese of 33 or something in that category, then I shouldn't say 33. 33 is obese. But if you have 29, you should already be taking five. That is what I would recommend. And mostly, just try portion control. If you go to a restaurant, tell the waiter to take away the bread. Because, you know, you talk with your hands. So you dabble with your fingers and you touch the food. And that's curtains in terms of your meal, you know, the carbohydrate
right.
that you're taking in.
Okay, I'm going to get into this. This is really important. It's been, you know, circulating recently. Some research recently has shown that women with PCOS have higher levels of bisphenol A, EPA, in their bodies than women without PCOS. The
Repeat again. I didn't hear you.
Some recent research has suggested that women with PCOS have higher levels of EPA in their bodies than women without PCOS.
Well, you got me because I don't know what BPA is.
It's bisphenol A. It's a toxin.
All right. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. That's fine. All right. And Sunshine is asking how to find a good doctor in Cleveland, Ohio.
Very.
How can one find a great endocrinologist or a great doctor to help with PCOS?
It's easy. You just look up and go to your doctor, and he has a list, I'm sure, that he can get, or go to a local endocrinologist, and if you're satisfied, fine. If you want to get a second opinion, you have an endocrinologist get you a member of any of the major societies, the endocrine, the ASRM, the Androgen Access Society, although we don't have a doctor referral line. Most
okay.
are chiefs of divisions and so forth. And, of course, by reputation, the people who do most of the writing, frankly, if you look up PCOS, and there is one website that is very interesting. You can get the full articles on something called the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And this you can get through, if you look up Google, you can look under PUBMED, PubMed, and put in PCOS and any question you have, and infertility, and acne, and so forth, and you get about 2,000 responses, including the abstract, and including some original articles in Journal of Clinical Endocrinology. That, I think, is the most important piece of information I gave all night. They can get free information written by experts, really.
Okay.
And
okay.
This is where to get it. And this is really what many, many of my patients even do before they come here. They look at PubMed. And you can look at the doctor, see how much he's written, and so forth.
Great. And on PCOSChallenge.com website, in the resources section, we do have a link to the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, and you can go and search there.
Yes, I'm a member of that, too. I love it.
Yes,
I've,
you are.
I've been a member there for a long while. Yeah.
Yes, you are. And, you know, that you can find an endocrinologist there, if that's the type of doctor you're
That's right. They have a directory.
Yes, they do.
AACE does have a directory. The Endocrine Society does have a directory. I'm sure
okay.
you can find it fairly
yeah,
easily.
Yeah, they can find it on... They can just go to PCOSChallenge.com in the resources section. And
there you go. I mean, look... You've been doing this for them right along, Ms. Adi.
Yeah.
I'm very
yeah,
proud.
They can find it there, yes.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Fodor White. We are not
going to
take up any more of your time tonight, but you have dispersed a wealth of information, and I'm just soaking it up, and I'm sure everybody else is too. Thank you so much, and we have to, you know, have you back on, because there are still a long list of questions that I didn't even get to yet.
Listen, this, you know, as my wife says, all I do is talk about PCO. Even so I stopped talking about it at home. She told me I eat, sleep, and drink PCO, so...
Well, you have a venue.
What are you
going to
do? You know, and that's it. So,
thank
you for that, and I'll be delighted to.
Okay, well, I can't wait to have you back on.
Okay.
And so... Before you go, I just wanted to remind everybody that there's also information at PCOSChallenge.net. There's the expert series. You can go there and find out more information about PCOS, learn more information about PCOS. And, of course, there's always the support network at PCOSChallenge.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Fodor White, for
My
being
pleasure.
Here. And helping us today, and we can't wait to hear from you again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay.
Good night, all.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the PCOS Challenge Radio Show. Tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. Also, be sure to join our social network at PCOSChallenge.com and sign up for our newsletter. This is Sasha Ati. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge.